program around this time, before the Discological Research and Sound Archives meeting, which is a joint Arskiaza presentation, we still have to listen to Michael Gray. And I didn't mean that to sound like it did. I'm looking forward to listening to what Michael Gray has to say about two-channel sound, stereo in the 50s and 60s. So we can get started. We can listen to what Michael has to say and then move on. Michael Gray is research librarian at Voice of America, and most of you know who he is, most of you in ARSC, and I need to say no more. Michael Gray and his two-channel sound, a look behind the scenes in the 50s and 60s, stereo recordings.
I am the sufferer of the first ARSC audio glitch of the meeting. The examples you'll hear in a few minutes are in mono. But use your imaginations fertilely, and you'll be able to hear what I'm talking about, and I'll explain what we hear after the conclusion of the presentation. That's one of our little surprises. I'm now passing around two handouts, one of which contains the setup diagrams for a number of famous records, the top sheet being the Pierre Monteux. He seems to be prominent in this session. Recordings of the Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, Firebird Suite, and Petrushka, engineered by Roy Wallace in the Salle Wagram in Paris in November 56. The following page, two pages, are the same piece, that is to say, the Rite of Spring, Raphael Fubik de Burgos, 1966, EMI Studios, London, engineered by Chris Parker. The third sheet is, again, our friend Pierre, Dawson Chloe, Maurice Ravel, 1959, engineered by Alan Reeve. And the fourth sheet is the same piece, the Boston Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Charles Munch, recorded in February 61. The engineer is Louis Leighton. These are examples of the kinds of things I'm going to be talking about. But in addition to that handout and the microphone handout, which you'll be seeing as well, I want to pass around some unique pictures, which will illustrate another aspect of the presentation. And these are pictures of Decca microphone setups. You'll see in a moment that I have four diagrams, none of which are the Decca recording company, I hasten to say. But in order to get an idea of what their setups look like, I have provided this picture, which will be going around from this side of the room to this side of the room, and I need this back. Thank you. We can all appreciate that the commercialization of stereo sound about 40 years ago introduced a way of recording music whose achievements for many of us remain alive today. This morning I intend to spend a short time talking about the men and the women who created this sound. Some of their names and many of the techniques they developed will be familiar to us. But by taking what I think is an interesting behind-the-scenes look at the birth and the first decade of commercial stereo, I hope I can provide a new perspective on a story whose fascination and importance I think remain important and fresh to this day. I picked the year 1954 to begin my story of stereo. This choice does not mean to slight the work of men like Alan Blumlein, William Snow, Harry F. Olson, Helmut Kruger, Bert White, or the dozens of other practitioners whose achievements help make the stereophonic era possible. I have instead chosen the year 1954 as a kind of beginning year, annus mirabilis, sorry, Jerry, the year in which stereo moved out of the laboratory and into the studio. I want to start my version of stereo story, or in this case mono story, by playing four little time capsules, each about a minute long, three from 1954 and one from the year before. I'm not going to tell you anything about these tapes just now, except to say that each one of these represents a different stereophonic technique, use your imaginations, and that elements of all of them in one way or another remain with us today. Make a note to yourselves about what you're going to hear, and I'll tell you what they are when we finish. Seth, the first one. I hope this is queued up. And the second one begins. Thank you. and so forth. The next sentence says, quote, "The key to the stereophonic images that we heard were brought into being in 1954, of course, was how the microphones we were using here, and I won't tell you what they are until the end, were deployed and mixed." That seems to be a pretty obvious piece of information. However, the models for the choices, as many of us know, had been well known since the 1930s. One of these techniques, roughly based on loudness and to some extent phase differences, caught by two nearly coincident microphones, was the work of Alan Blumlein at EMI's Central Research Laboratories in the United Kingdom. The other, based on intensity, phase, and timing differences created by widely spaced microphones, had arisen from experiments by, among others, and most famously, by William Snow at Bell Labs in the early 1930s. And we heard a presentation from Arthur Keller in 1981 in Capitol Hill about these experiments and heard some of the examples at that time. The making of stereo sound, however, at RCA Victor and at Decca in EMI, see my little pins, in Britain, the companies I have chosen to represent the development of commercial stereo, though I will talk about other companies as well, rested not just on the theory of stereo that Blumlein and Snow identified, but on the theory mediated and eventually altered by institutional traditions and, most importantly, by the personal taste of the engineers who were actually recording the music. Now let's take the plunge from those general observations to the specific. And I'd like to frame this discussion by identifying what I consider to be three significant periods, to use that well-worn historical convention, into which the commercialization of stereo, I think, rather naturally falls. I'll call these periods the eras of experimentation, elaboration, and convergence. None of these periods, of course, have hard and fast borders. And while the stereotypes that wildly spaced microphones were an American habit and coincident pickups, you'll see pictures, were a European one, like all stereotypes, true as far as they go, the story is also, as we might expect and we shall see, a little more complicated than that. Let's begin our detailed look at the era of experimentation, the period roughly from 1954 to 56. When the techniques and equipment developed in the laboratory were applied for the first time to the real world of the recording studio. This was, as we might expect, an era in which distinctions between techniques were at their greatest and the stereotypes they reflect most clearly defined. To make best sense, I'm going to look at some recording sessions, actual recording sessions, and I'm going to start with, is Bernadette here? Bernadette is here, thank you. Very good. Bernadette will appreciate this. I'm going to now look at the classic recording, one that is currently available on CD and a transfer in the Living Stereo series, of Richard Strauss's Also Sprach Zarathustra and Ein Heldenleben, what else, with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra under Fritz Reiner, made in March of 1956 in Orchestra Hall by engineer Leslie Chase, March of 54, by Leslie Chase and producer Jack Pfeiffer. I should note that Les Chase, whom I just talked to about this session in 1987, was not a balance engineer at all. He was a maintenance man. And we will see as we go through the history, early history of this period, that folks who were in the junior grade of the hierarchy at record companies were often dragooned or otherwise persuaded to undertake the stereo work, which was not as important as monophonic recording, at least in the early days. We all know, or most of us know, that these sessions were not, in fact, RCA's first work in stereo at a commercial session. That had occurred the month before in Boston, recording The Damnation of Faust with Charles Munch and the Boston Symphony. Chase himself, however, and the lead engineer in Chicago, the famous Louis Leighton, had also participated in a purely experimental binaural session with Leopold Stokowski at Manhattan Center the previous October. And I think it's from those experiments that the technique I'm going to show you in a minute evolved. I'm going to go with a chart, which is cleverly hidden, you see, so you wouldn't have to see it before I could display it. Voila. I hope that's the right one. Is that number one? Yes, Russell. That's number one. Okay. this case. In any event, the other thing that's important about this session is not just where those microphones are, but the fact that the 247s, and if you see the diagram that's working its way around the room right now, are set in cardioid pattern. It's a directional pattern. The ideal of omnidirectional mode was an ideal that was practiced most thoroughly and most sternly by Mercury and Bob Fine. The microphones in that case being first U47s and later the Sheps 201M. This was a style that for about the first 2 years of stereo, first with Chase Recording and then later Leighton himself, when the double stereo crew that Chase was on was eliminated in favor of a two-channel tape that could be used for mono and stereo, was adhered to pretty thoroughly. Changing those left and right pickups at times to Neumann M49s, that's pictured in the, those are in the picture that I'm circulating, and also by adding what we call onstage helpers, or in Leighton's words, sweeteners, to fix what became the obvious fault of this technique, which is the hole in the middle. The hole in the middle, if you talk to EMI people, was one thing they devoutly wanted to avoid. Their technique was not so much based on the experiments as it was on review of the literature. And by November of 53, 1 month after Chase and Leighton had recorded in Manhattan Center, Philip Vanderlyn, who was one of the chief investigators at the Central Research Laboratories succeeding Alan Blumlein, who had been killed in a plane crash in 1942, had concluded in a memo that of all the techniques surveyed in the literature to that time, the EMI Blumlein system is as likely to prove as cheap as any other system considered. Now, to validate this conclusion, EMI began testing what they call binaural systems, and you notice I have not used that phrase yet. That was a phrase used commonly at the time, but binaural meant a specific technique. Listen on headphones rather than on loudspeakers, which was, quote, stereophonic. Those sessions began in May of 1954, and they tested a variety of separated and coincident microphone systems using both EMI's traditional ribbon microphones and the Neumann M49. By the fall of 1954, after almost 70 sessions of tests, EMI had at last settled on their experimental system, which is based on a Blumlein pair of Neumann M49s mounted head-to-head in a case. At the conclusion of this talk, I have Buku pictures if you want to see what that looks like. It was a case about like this, one microphone like this, one microphone like this, facing clunk like this. Sorry, clunk, yes. Unlike the RCA technique, which consisted of two mono mixers and some microphones and an Ampex, in this case an RT21 RCA recorder, this one consisted of not just the microphone and its mixer, but a rack full, and I have a picture of the rack full of equipment, containing the shuffler, sum and difference networks, filters, and equalizers that were part and parcel of the Blumlein-ish technique that EMI was using. This was first deployed in February 7th, 1955, with junior engineer Christopher Parker recording music by Prokofiev in Kingsway Hall, London, conducted by Nikolai Malko. I should make clear, however, that in EMI's case, the commercialization of this process was always foremost in their mind. And 2 months later, EMI held a famous press conference in their number 2 studio, hosted by conductor Sir Malcolm Sargent, in which they introduced the results of this system to which EMI had given the name Stereosonic. By the fall of that year, EMI became one of the first companies to issue two-track stereo tapes based on the recording sessions that they had made in the spring and summer of that year. The sound of these tapes, unlike the sound of the AB system, conveyed a technique that would be deployed without significant change, except for the introduction of a new mixer, somewhat more flexible new mixer, in early 1956. That would continue for most of the next 3 years until 1958. There was, of course, a third way to do stereo in 1954, and that was the Decca way. Its creator was a man named Roy Wallace, an engineer who I believe has received too little credit for the invention of what we all know today as the Decca tree. If the picture is working its way around, you'll see two trees, one of which is the two trees in Vienna, one of which I'll explain to you in a minute what those are when I get to my text. The tree consisted of nothing more than a tree or microphones. How many people have seen a picture of a tree? A few, okay. Well, the whole idea of the tree was A and B facing this way, C facing forward, just like this. Roughly these distances, in fact. The tree consisted of one microphone, two microphone, three microphone in front. The tree seems to be nothing more than AB microphones that are being shoved rather close together, not as close as ORTF, with that third microphone in the center to fill up the hole in the middle. However, the tree really reflected, and Wallace's experiments had shown that in 1953, a sophisticated understanding that stereo needed to have both the phase, base phase coherence provided by the nearness of these microphones, this distance, plus the solid stereo image provided by their directional orientation. In the beginning, Wallace was the principal investigator for Decca stereo, and throughout its experimental period, he provided its direction and character. Wallace built the mixers, at first a 6-channel and then a 9-channel model, and experimented with its microphones. In the beginning, in May of 1954, there were three Neumann M49s, directionally patterned, set A, B, and C. Later, he moved to an enclosed or baffled trio of N50s. That tree is included in one of the pictures that's circulating now. Later trees included baffled, that is to say, separated by boards A, B, and C, Neumann KM50s, and at last, an open tree consisting of three cardioid patterned KM56s. Now, all of the techniques we've talked about produce some wonderful sounding records, records that at least I treasure, and many of which have been issued on CD in the past 10 years. And stereo sound in this experimental manner would have been good enough, probably would have been good enough, if three factors had not helped shove it rather quickly into my next era, the era of elaboration. The first factor in creating this era was, of course, competition. By the end of 1956, a host of classical recording companies, ranging from Capitol, Columbia, Vanguard, and Westminster in the US, and this is by no means a complete list, to Deutsche Grammophon and Teldec in Europe, had undertaken significant stereophonic activity of their own that would soon enlarge the catalog of stereophonic tapes that had started to reach the market, as we've already seen, late in 1955. The second factor impelling a change was recording operas. It, in fact, had been the LP itself that had made recording complete operas musically and financially feasible. And both Decca and EMI, in fact, had recorded a number of operas stereophonically during the experimental period, although only EMI had actually published the results of its sessions. That was the Nozze di Figaro from the summer of 1955, on a set of 2-track tapes as part of the initial stereosonic issue. Really solving the opera recording problem would require either more mixing channels or more recording channels, or both. At Decca and EMI, the companies in Europe I'm concentrating on, the solution was to build mixers with more microphone channels, but to continue to record onto 2 tracks. Bigger mixers were also becoming routine at RCA. An 8-channel unit, for instance, had become the session remote recording standard by early 1956, and further mixers would come in the near future. Yet for RCA, and eventually for most Americans, the solution was not only bigger mixers, but an extra recording channel too. Here the equipment of use was the famous Ampex 300-3 recorder using half-inch recording tape, a machine that Mercury had already adopted in the spring of 1955 for its own stereophonic recording, and one that within 3 years would, for most, though not all as yet, American companies become the standard classical recording machine. The third factor, obviously, in developing stereo was the LP record itself. For even as recording session technique was moving into the more elaborate style in 1956, other industry technical leaders were working out the details for the 2-channel single-grooved record. By the fall of 57, these industry representatives, including all the companies I've mentioned so far, had settled on the Westrex 45-45 system. 45-45 meaning that one, it modulates the groove, one side of the groove is left, one side is right. The competing system, by the way, was vertical lateral, modulating vertical for left or right, horizontal for left or right. Freiman, okay, good, we'll skip. Okay. Let's have a look at how the elaborate style, we're gonna move from my Yak Yak to some pictures, because I think it's important to look at the pictures. I'm gonna move from the simple style that we've seen here in this picture to the more elaborate style of two companies, RCA and EMI, one in 58 and one in 59. Now seeing what EMI and RCA could do, but let me describe briefly what Deutsche Grammophon was up to. Deutsche Grammophon got into the stereo business later, as did Philips, engaging in 56 some freelance work for the Arkeef label, but beginning in 57 its own experience using the MS technique in May of 1957, Erich Fischer's version of Beethoven's Fidelio. However, by April of 58, Deutsche Grammophon had already leaped from those simple experiments to a full-blown elaborate style, which I will describe, using a pair of Neumann SM2 microphones. These are crossed pairs, like this, as the primary microphones with timpani, horn, brass, and organ spots, and their own version of the left and right stereo outriggers, or AB microphones. According to engineer Hans Peter Schweigmann, who was actually there at those sessions, the idea of stereo DG, at least, was in the air. Let me finally get to the era of convergence, and I'll skip the printed part of the paper and simply show you, because I have very little time, am I right? That's right. Okay. You can read this later. Yeah. have occurred, and then I will conclude. I identified several reasons for the development of this style. Wherever it was pictured, and you can see many, many other session pictures if you like, but there, as far as I was concerned, there were three reasons for this style. One was the factor of money. It cost money to do recording sessions. It cost more money in the 60s than in the 50s. And recording session costs being what they were, it was safer to do an elaborate technique with a lot of microphones and a good mixer than it was to do a purist technique, the purist technique taking a lot of time to set up. The second factor, and an equally important factor, was the factor of equipment. As you can see from this diagram, which I passed around, this, by the way, was made by the late Neville Boiling, and I obtained some of Neville's papers. Neville was an engineer at EMI. He drew he, for his own edification, drew a picture of the microphones and their capture patterns. This equipment included multi-track tapes. Multi-track had been used in opera recording to back up the two-channel mix as early as 1959 at EMI. And as early as the mid-60s at Decca. In addition, you had newer microphones like the Neumann UF67, the UF87, the KM84, and other models depicted here, which gave engineers additional tools with which to make their sound. Finally, it took tape formulations like Scotch 102, 202, and 203, and most importantly, Dolby noise reduction, which gave balance engineers in the 60s the chance to move more microphones more close to the sound than they had been able to do in the early days. Almost done. By the middle and certainly by the late 60s, stereo had reached what I would call its first maturity, driven by technique, as we've seen, by the perceived demands of the market, and by the evolving taste of engineers and producers. The stage was now set for the sound of the 70s, for quad, and what became an ever-increasing proliferations of recording tracks that created images, at least in my mind, no longer had a lot of relationship to the space in which the music was occurring. I and many others look on the years that we've just talked about briefly as a golden age of stereo recording. Think about the records you treasure most, and then see how many were made in the 50s and 60s. However you view these years, they remain a unique era of unparalleled artistic and technical advance, one that through its achievements remains very much with us today. End of story. Thank you. That was what I was going to say. Okay. How many guess what the first... Well, everybody know what the pieces were, right? Okay. Well, anyway, I'll tell you briefly. The first one was the Franck Symphony in D minor, Guido Cantelli in the NBC Symphony, RCA ER E4 RP81701. 30 IPS, quote, binaural, Carnegie Hall, 6th of April, 1954. The second one was the Hutter's Chorus from Der Freischütz, the Teldec Studio, Berlin, 1953. That was done on a Telefunken K8, two-channel modified recorder in MS. The third one was the motet, Sing Unto the Lord, A New Song, Teldec Studio, April, 54. Three 49s in front, two 49s in back. The last one is my most prized one, the first Decca recording session in stereo. The music was Antar by Rimsky-Korsakov, recorded 17th of May, 1954 by Roy Wallace. Thank you, and if you want to see my pictures or any of the little documents, please come see me later. By the way, thank you to Dottie Gray, who did the wonderful, wonderful pictures last night. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael. I'm sure you all have lots of questions and all that, but really, time just doesn't allow. Michael would be around, so just grab him wherever, any opportunity you can get. Well, don't grab him, but go up to him and ask him your questions, and I'm sure he'll be willing to answer them. At this point in the program, we're having a combined Ars Gyaza session. It's...